Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Imagine arriving by boat, the only means of transport, in a rural town of 150,000 people where two rivers join in south central China on a moonlit night as one of the first of two Americans to live in this town in the past 50 years and speaking very little Chinese. This is the experience of Peter Hessler, the author of River Town. Peter Hessler was a Peace Corps volunteer in China from 1996 to 1998. Now, Peter Hessler lives and works full-time in Beijing, China, as a correspondent for the New Yorker magazine. River Town tells the story of his experience and observations in Fuling, China. I spoke with Peter Hessler by phone as he was passing through San Francisco and asked him to begin our conversation by telling us what originally drew him to China.
It was in a way very, very accidental. I had no interest as a student in either college or grad school. I had no interest at all. And I was in college in 1989 when there was so much attention during the June 4th massacre in Beijing, and so much attention was focused on China and the possibilities of democracy there. And I was really oblivious to all that. I just wasn't interested. And it's partly because I think for me college was a matter of leaving Missouri and sort of slowly expanding my view of the world. I wasn't looking that far yet. After college, I went to grad school in England for a couple of years. And on my way back from England, I traveled through Asia, and I happened to travel through China, and something about it interested me. I think partly it was just a sense of energy. When you're in China, there's just a sense of things happening. There's a lot of people out in the street. People seem to be working. They seem to be trying to improve their lives. And you can really, it's kind of a palpable energy there. And it sort of fascinated me. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to go back.
Well, did the Peace Corps find you, or did you find the Peace Corps?
Well, I had applied to the Peace Corps, actually, when I was an undergrad at Princeton. And I pulled out my application because I got a scholarship to go to grad school. But then after I finished grad school, I decided to, that I was still interested in doing the Peace Corps. And so I applied again. And when I applied, I told them I wanted to go to Asia, and then I found out they had a China program, and that was my first choice.
So you arrived in the town of Fuling at the confluence of the Yangtze and the Wu River. You and your partner were, or your Peace Corps associate, you and your Peace Corps associate were the only Americans who had lived there in over 50 years?
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit blurry in people's memory as to who was the last American resident there. But it had been before the Communist Revolution, which was 1949. And there had been a couple of other foreign residents. There was a German who was teaching at another school. But he wasn't there for very long. And so for most of the time we were there, we were the only ones.
Well, tell us about it, your arrival, your reception.
The Peace Corps was a pretty new program, and we were only the third Peace Corps group in China. There were only 14 in my group, and 8 from the year before, so a total of 22 in all of China. And the town where I lived in, Fuling, had not had any Peace Corps volunteers. So there was a lot of efforts on both sides to make this a good experience. I mean, the college was going out of their way, and we were trying to go out of our way. But it was, to some degree, kind of clumsy at the beginning on for both of us. There were language issues. I didn't speak much Chinese at all when I arrived. And it's very intimidating to show up in a city like this. I mean, this is a place where you have to come and go on boat. It doesn't have, when we were there, it did not have a highway or a railroad. We didn't have other foreigners passing through. There was an enormous amount of attention. If we went anywhere in town, you'd immediately draw a crowd. If you're just picking up something at a shop, there'd be, 20, 30 people gathered around talking about you and staring at you. And it was very disconcerting at the beginning.
What sort of privacy did you have? I understand your mail was opened and sometimes censored. Other personal things were looked at?
In a situation like this, yeah, I mean, you're giving up part of that. And part of what made it so hard is that you stand out so much. You're never invisible. You know, if I went to the city, there's always people keeping track of me. I mean, just out of curiosity for the most part. I mean, like I say, these crowds that would gather to watch you, and they would talk about it. So, you know, later I'd hear from other friends, oh, I heard you were in that part of the city yesterday, or I heard you went over to this temple, I heard you went to this shop. And, you know, word would travel, and it definitely, you felt like you were living under a microscope. But then, of course, there was the political element. I mean, China is a communist country. The Chinese were very suspicious of the Peace Corps, you know, this organization that has links to the U.S. government, and it was very difficult for the Peace Corps to get to China, and they kept track of us. I mean, there was evidence that my mail had been looked at, and certainly the students were requested to keep track of things we said in class and report them, and, you know, we knew for a fact that some of that stuff ended up in the police stations, and it was, you know, we all had files, and they kept track of sort of what we were up to.
When you say in class, your classes were taught in English or in Chinese?
Our classes were entirely in English. We were teaching, I was teaching at a college. This was a 3-year college. It wasn't a full bachelor's degree, but it was sort of the equivalent of a junior college in China. And this was a teacher's college. They were training young people to be middle school teachers, and specifically middle school teachers for the countryside. So most of my students came from rural backgrounds. They came from peasant homes, and then they would return to the peasant areas to teach. And we were teaching an English major, so they had had a lot of English. They had studied English for about 7 years, and you know, they were seniors. They were finishing up, and so I actually taught them literature. I mean, I taught fairly advanced stuff.
What was their reception of the literature that you taught? I presume that was literature based in English, because that's your familiarity.
Yeah, it was English literature. You know, I mean, I taught them. You know, we started with Beowulf. We did Shakespeare. We did, and then when we did an American unit, you know, Robert Frost and Mark Twain. And so, you know, I could sort of, and they were. It was a great experience. I was a literature major as an undergrad and as a grad student, and in some ways things became very fresh when you're teaching them in another culture like this. They hadn't heard a lot of these stories and a lot of these poems and novels and stories that to us, you know, seem a bit cliche because we've looked at them so often. I mean, something like Beowulf, you know, which if you're a college student and somebody assigns Beowulf, you've probably already seen it before, and you sort of grown. And, you know, my students had no preconceptions about any of this. And, you know, Beowulf to them was, you know, an interesting story about a monster. And you know, and of course there were always connections. When they wrote about Beowulf, they would take the side of the, you know, of the working class and say, well, you know, Beowulf is, you know, he represents the, you know, the nobility, and he's oppressing the peasants. And this would become because they had come from peasant homes and because they had been brought up in a communist mind frame. So, you know, there are all different angles that you could see people coming at this stuff from.
What was the student response to the Mark Twain stories that you taught?
Oh, they love Twain. Twain translates well. Although sometimes I didn't give them, you know, language was an issue. They had good English, but a lot of times you couldn't, you know, I wasn't going to give them Beowulf in the original or even in a translation of the old English. I mean, it was so often I would summarize these things. Sometimes I told them. Sometimes you would just tell the stories. And I remember doing that with Twain, with the jumping frog of Calaveras County, and just sort of telling that story to them. And they loved it. I mean, that's because Twain, you know, was at heart a storyteller. A lot of his work is sort of, you know, in the oral tradition. You know, his style is following that. And so it's, you know, makes for a very natural way to approach it with students of a foreign language, actually.
When you read your students' papers, what kinds of things came out in the allegories that your students presented that would not come out in the conversation?
One thing that came out was sort of, I think, sort of their fluency and their ability with language. I mean, it was very often their spoken English was actually quite weak because they hadn't ever met a foreigner before. They had studied this language entirely in small parts of China. But they had read enormously, and they had written enormously, and they wrote quite beautifully. And so sometimes, you know, you could kind of be you could underestimate them quite easily, but when you read what they're writing, it was, they came through a different level. I mean, when we read, the Shakespeare sonnet, "The Shall I Compare Thee to a Summer's Day," and I asked my students to, what do you imagine when you hear this poem? What's the person that the poet's describing? What does she look like? And, the things that they wrote were amazing. I can read a couple of them here. I mean, for example, one student said, "She looks like a slim and graceful lotus that is beginning to blossom. Her long hair is like a waterfall." Another student wrote, "She is slim with long black hair. Her brows are like two leaves of willow. Her skin is white and soft, like cooked fat." Another student wrote, "Her skin is so smooth that you would suspect it is made of marble. Her waist is as soft as water grass, and her fingers are as slim as the root of onion." And you had all of these comparisons that were obviously coming from Chinese poetry. I mean, comparing somebody's skin to cooked fat or fingers to onions. And it was, it was fascinating for me to see this. And so for me, it was a way to look at Chinese literature and Chinese culture as well.
Were you questioned much by your students about life in America?
Well, certainly.
What did they want to know?
The range. I mean, in China, almost part of the problem with the way America is perceived is it's extremes. I mean, you have a group of people who see America as a place where everybody has plenty of money and life is very easy, and it's all better than China. And then you have a group of people who see America sort of from the propaganda viewpoint, where America is full of crime and racism and sexism, and is a very unfair place. And part of what I tried to do was, when I spoke about America, was to place it somewhere between these two views. I felt like some of these people who are idealizing America, I'd like to disabuse them of those notions, but I also, wanted to let people know that some of the propaganda that they were getting wasn't entirely accurate.
I'd like to take a minute and say that this week on Radio Curious, we're talking with Peter Hessler, a young man who was a Peace Corps volunteer in very rural China in a town of Fuling, where he could only arrive or leave by boat at the confluence of the Wu River and the Yangtze River. He wrote a book about his experience called River Town, 2 years on the Yangtze. Peter is now a correspondent with The New Yorker based in Beijing. I'm talking to him from his hotel in San Francisco while he's passing through the United States in return to China. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Peter, this part of the Yangtze River where you were living is going to be flooded with the new dams that will close off part of the river beginning next year. What is the anticipation of the people who live there about this change that will occur?
Yeah, it is a massive change. I mean, this is a dam that's supposedly they're going to complete the first stage toward the end of this year. And there's about 2 million people who have to be moved in this process. When the water rises, it's going to flood 13 cities and 140 towns and more than 1,300 villages. This is an area with an enormous amount of life. I mean, if you look at the Yangtze River, it's one of the most populated areas on Earth. I mean, the watershed of the Yangtze has a population of 350 million. I mean, that's more people than in America and Canada combined. This is, a very important part of the world. And this project's going to have a huge effect on the town that I lived in, on Fuling. So, I knew going in that this was a major issue, and you could see preparations all over the place. I mean, you could walk through town and you would see, lines painted on in the city down near the river that would say this is where the water's going to rise in 2003, and they'd have these watermarks all along the river in that part of China. I was very surprised I was very surprised basically at the passivity of people there. I didn't hear a lot of people asking questions about it, and I really never knew anybody who was opposed to it. And, the reasons for this are complicated, and part of it is simply not having access to a lot of information. There's been a lot of criticism of the dam in the Western world. A lot of experts, especially foreign experts, believe that it's a very risky idea and not something China should be undertaking.
Why? What is the risk that they propose?
Well, I mean, part of it is just big dams are just not built anymore. I mean, America went through this earlier in the 20th century, and as you notice now, we sort of don't build massive dams anymore. And actually, some of them have been destroyed. And part of this is a social issue. I mean, it's been shown over and over again. Whenever you're moving people, in big groups like this, and sort of disrupting their life, there's all sorts of social problems that develop from that. It's just very hard on communities. That's one issue when you've got about 2 million people that actually have to be moved, and then millions more who are affected in other indirect ways. That's a major issue. The other issue is simply technical. The Yangtze is a very, very muddy river, and they're not. There's been debate on how a massive dam like this is going to handle the silt. You know, is it going to silt up? There's some people who believe that's going to happen, and that it won't even be functioning for very long. You know, and then there's this safety issues of, you know, if you have something this big, what happens if you have an earthquake, or if there's, you know, some sort of terrorist attack or anything else like this? I mean, it's a very dangerous thing to have right in the heart of your country. So those are some of the issues, and these have been discussed a lot in the outside world, but in China it's banned from the press. You're not allowed to criticize this project directly, and so most of the people in my town hadn't heard these arguments. But there's also another element to it, which is simply that China is a country that has been developing very rapidly since 1978, and to some degree, people are really, obsessed with this sense of trying to improve their station in life. And it's very understandable. I mean, Fuling and the other cities there in the Yangtze River are quite poor. I mean, these are areas where it wasn't very long ago that people didn't have enough to eat. I mean, now that's not so much of a problem, but, you know, we still had very irregular power during certain times of the year. We have a lot of power cutoffs, and most people didn't have electric heating or, you know, these sort of luxuries. And they saw the dam as a way to raise their living standards. They thought it was going to produce more electricity and sort of make their lives easier.
Peter, in your book, you have a very colorful story about a blind beggar who talks about his life. Can you tell us about that?
Sort of typical street life in a place like Fuling. It's just he was a wanderer who was out begging, and he had written his story out on a little piece of cardboard, and he had a story of his life and how he'd been a peasant and lost his sight and was now reduced to begging. This is something you often saw in these small towns. It's not that much different from America in some ways, where you see people with in San Francisco or any city, with a beggar will have some kind of billboard. But in China, these could be very long stories and sometimes quite well written and quite vivid in explaining, their situation.
In general, what's your take on the Peace Corps, the kind of operation that it is, based on your China experience and what you may have learned from some of us who have been volunteers in other countries?
The best thing about the Peace Corps is that it does become a sort of exchange in that, for somebody like me, I was sent to this town and my job was to teach English, and this town needed English teachers. There was no question that they needed that sort of work. They also needed to have foreigners. This was a place that I think benefited from having contact with the outside world. And see, you really felt like you're doing something useful. But at the same time, there were all sorts of things that I gained. I mean, I was able to learn Chinese. I was able to get a very unusual background in China. There's not very many people not too many foreigners who have an opportunity to live in a city like that. And, and since then, I've been able to use this experience to write and to establish myself in Beijing as a correspondent. And, I really looked at those 2 years as an exchange. I mean, I felt like I was serving something. I was serving that community, and that community was serving me. And I think that's a very healthy way to do development work. But it's very difficult to do. There's not many opportunities for this. It's hard for the World Bank or sort of other big development projects to sort of approach the world in this way. But I think it's very healthy. It sort of makes it more equal. It prevents you from being sort of condescending to looking at these people as, people who just need your help. I mean, they also have something to offer you.
Have you been able to maintain contact with friendships that you made when you lived there, now that you've been gone for several years?
I go back probably twice a year. And I live in Beijing. It's not that far. I often have phone calls from friends down there and quite a few emails. I'm actually in quite close touch with them, which is one of the nice things about going back there to work. So I hear from a lot of my former students. I've written stories about a few of them, and I still go back and visit my teachers and some of my colleagues.
As a correspondent for the New Yorker magazine living in Beijing, what are your topics? What is your range of ability to investigate things that you find interesting?
Well, I'm doing sort of longer feature stories. I don't write about the news so much, and my goal is to write more about kind of everyday life in China. Last year I did a very long piece about a factory worker in the south of China, you know, a migrant who had lived in my town and who went south to look for work, and I followed her experience for over the course of 2 years. I wrote last year about the Chinese bid for the Olympics, and now I'm working on a story about the Chinese language and about some of the political issues involved there. It's a huge range. I also do some work for National Geographic. I just did a month-long driving trip where I drove alone across northern China. So my goal is sort of to stay close to the ground. I want to be able to do stories where I can talk more with average people. I'm not that interested in the politics there, and that's partly because I feel like your access is more limited. It's very hard to talk with government officials. It's hard to spend much time with them. But if you're just writing about average people, you have so much more freedom with what you're doing, and that's kind of my goal there.
What's your personal life, your social life like living in Beijing?
It's there's sort of different worlds that you can shift between. I mean, I live in a Chinese neighborhood and in sort of an old part of Beijing, one of the traditional neighborhoods, and there's the group of locals that I will spend time with. I mean, there's mostly old retired men who kind of hang out on the corner and they play Chinese chess and they chat, and I usually hang out with them a couple times a week, and it's a great way to sort of see how life survives in these old parts of Beijing. And then I also have kind of a group of Chinese intellectual friends, a couple of friends who are correspondents for Chinese papers or have other jobs of that sort. And then I have a group of expat friends, I mean, sort of Americans or other foreigners who are living over there. And it's one of the nice things about being there is you can have these different circles of people that you see on a regular basis. I have a home in the countryside outside of Beijing in a very small village, and I spend weekends out there.
Do you find that when you are traveling or being in Beijing that you stand out so distinctly as you did in Fuling?
No, it's very different. It's like, I mean, this is part of what is very characteristic of China at this stage. I mean, China is a country that's developing so rapidly, but it's not an even development. In some parts of the country, have developed faster than others. And China really has never been a particularly unified country. I mean, the sense of it has always been unified. It's always portrayed itself as a very unified country. But there's enormous differences in dialects and in culture and also in development. And this is very true of today's China, just as it was true, 1,000 years ago. And, a place like Fuling, the people's ideas and their dialect is very different from Beijing. And when I'm in Beijing, nobody's going to look twice at me. There's a lot of foreigners around there when I go. But at the same time, it doesn't take very, very, very far to go to a different world. I mean, I have a home in the countryside. It takes less than 2 hours for me to drive there. And when I go to that village, I mean, it's life's very slow. People are, there's no shops, there's no restaurants. I have two neighbors who have bound feet. I mean, these are old ladies in their 80s. Some of the locals have never even been to Beijing. It's like stepping back in time.
Do you think living in China is going to be a permanent factor in your life or for the indeterminate future?
No, I think I'll probably stay for a couple more years, and then I would like to come back to the U.S. and live at least for a while. I mean, I think China is going to be a permanent place that I go back to, and there'll be different points in life when I live there, I think, but I wouldn't want to live full-time in Beijing for sort of the rest of my life. And one thing, it's a bit hard on your health. The pollution's quite bad. But I think also just as a writer, sometimes it's good to get a little bit of distance, and I think also sometimes it's good to reconnect with with your home culture, and that's something that I'll probably think about doing in a couple of years.
When you are in China, are there things about America that stand out as something you miss?
Mostly what I would miss is just people. I mean, I miss being able to see family and friends. I'm at the point now where it's really, there's not too much else that I really miss. I guess, I would have to say the one thing is probably having clean air and having, places where you can go and take a walk in the woods or hike up a mountain and having places like this that are fairly accessible, even if you're living in a city. It's one of the problems with Beijing is it's such a huge city. It's 13 million people. It's sprawling. The air is bad. And you don't really have the attention to parks and to things like that. And so that is something I miss. But as far as things you eat or routines on a daily basis, I don't really, I've gotten to the point where there's nothing I really long for there.
Well, Peter Hessler, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you to tell us about an interesting book.
Okay. One book that I'm reading at the moment, and I actually sort of read this pretty regularly, I've read it a few times in the past, is a book called This Boy's Life, which is a memoir by a writer named Tobias Wolff. It's one of my favorite books. It's very funny, beautifully written. It's about a boy, it's a memory of a childhood of a boy who was whose parents were divorced, and he's living with his mother and sort of traveling across America and basically trying to find his identity, and it's just a very funny book. It's one of my favorite memoirs of all time.
It's actually one of my favorite ones too. Well, Peter Hessler, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you.
Peter Hessler is the author of Rivertown, the story of his experience as a Peace Corps volunteer in Fuling, China, from 1996 to 1998. The book that he recommends is This Boy's Life by Tobias Wolff. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious are available at cost for $10 each. I'll give you the address in just a moment. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your cards, letters, suggestions, and ideas for future programs. Here's the address. Radio Curious, Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. And the email is curious@pacific.net. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Stay curious, be creative, and join us again next week.